Before we start, Erin just told me that her aunt has called saying that her daughter, her aunt's daughter is about 25, is really very seriously ill. And the surgery team is going to come in, I think, today or tomorrow soon to determine whether or not the surgery will actually help her. So she's in really serious condition, and so... So her aunt called Erin and asked Erin to ask us if we would pray for her. Say some prayers. I think that's very beautiful of her to ask us to do that. So I thought we could do... her name is Samantha. She's 25 years old. I think she lives in Canada. Right? Yeah. So we can just visualize her... that she become well and healthy and survive this really very, actually very serious situation. So, that's why we do 11 triumphal mantras. Mm-hmm. Do you want to lead it for your tone?
Sure.
Thank you. Well, that's it.
Om Trayambakaya Jamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Urvarukamiva Vandhanam Mrityor Mukshiyamamrtaat Om Trayambakaya Jamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Urvarukamiva Vandhanam Mrityor Mukshiyamamrtaat Om Trayambakaya Jamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Urvarukamiva Vandhanam Mrityor Mukshiyamamrtaat Om Trayambakaya Jamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Urvarukamiva Vandhanam Mrityor Mukshiyamamrtaat Om Trayambakaya Jamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Urvarukamiva Vandhanam Mrityor Mukshiyamamrtaat Om Trayambakaya Jamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Urvarukamiva Vandhanam Mrityor Mukshiyamamrtaat Om Trayambakaya Jamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Urvarukamiva Vandhanam Mrityor Mukshiyamamrtaat Om Trayambakaya Jamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Urvarukamiva Vandhanam Mrityor Mukshiyamamrtaat Om Trayambakaya Jamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Urvarukamiva Vandhanam Mrityor Mukshiyamamrtaat Om Trayambakaya Jamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Urvarukamiva Vandhanam Mrityor Mukshiyamamrtaat Om Trayambakaya Jamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Urvarukamiva Vandhanam Mrityor Mukshiyamamrtaat Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti.
Harihi
Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harihi Om.
Yes, you do well. How can we have some scars from previous lives if I was never born, not subject to birth and death? Yeah. Because the self, the one who's never born, free from time, non-dual, is not subject to any kind of samskaras. And in fact, so this question means there's a lot that has to be unfolded to really deeply explain this question. Okay. So I'm just going to do it very briefly and know that this kind of unfoldment will be taking place throughout the month, but because it's a little bit of a big question. As we've been unfolding in the classes for Keanu Upanishad these last two or three days, that there's been a real emphasis on kind of the non-dual nature of your being, that your being is not something that can be objectified or that has hands and legs or mind, and all of the upadis, this body, mind, sense organs, the one who's transmigrating, who's traveling, that's all mithya. All of that belongs to the creation. In fact, from a larger scale, it's part and parcel of Ishwara. You're this body, mind, sense organs. It's like a cell in the body of Ishwara. And so it's subject to all of the laws, subject to punya and papa, you know, and utilizes all of the sense organs, all of these things. And there's birth, death, birth, death, birth, death from beginningless time. But that is not who you are, right? From the standpoint of this body, mind, sense organs, body, mind, sense organs with all its punya and papa and karmas, birth and death, that's totally dependent upon the Atma, your self-conscious being, as the adhishtana of this mithya world that we've been talking about. But from the standpoint of you, in fact, there is really nothing but consciousness. The experience of samsara, or the experience of the world, requires the world to be there. Yourself is the luminary of the world, the conscious being because of which this whole creation is and is known. But from your own standpoint, you're not a character within the dream. The whole, you can be, but not from the standpoint of the self. You can take a character within the dream and be operating in the dream, or you can be as though the Ishwara of the dream. But just of the dream or of the imagination. But just think like this then. When you have an imagination or when you have a dream is known. That imagination is known. But for it to be known, or for a character to be having experiences within that dream or within that imagination, that character has to be there. And when it's there, because it's nitya, it's totally dependent upon the adhishtana, which is conscious being. So all of the experiences that there are, the experience of Ishwara, the total, or the experience of all of the jivas within that total, has to be there for that experience to be had. Consciousness is just simply consciousness. It's not a knower of the experience. Like, oh, look at what's going on now. You know, there's nobody who has a subject-object relationship with that, because consciousness is non-dual, just me. But this whole universe that expresses itself, Maya expressing itself in a cyclical fashion, when it's expressed because of the sattva, sattva, rajas, tamas, which make up Maya, the whole thing is known, right? Because of the sattva, it as though reflects consciousness, as though manifests consciousness, so the whole thing gets to be known. But what about when it's an unmanifest condition? Then it's not known, because it's not there to be known. Atma is not a knower. It's the sat-chit. It's the, in trying to translate sat-chit in terms of this creation, It is the existence, the being of the creation, and it is the knownness of the creation. Without consciousness, this creation has no means to be known. Even imagine having a vritti in your mind, but there's no consciousness. You have to have consciousness for that vritti to be meaningful, right? Otherwise, it's just an inert vritti. I'm the consciousness because of which all of these vrittis experience being known. Now, the other day, I don't know, it might have been a little obtuse, but the experience, the knownness that the vrittis take on for themselves is really nothing but the self-evident nature of consciousness. So it's not even that the vrittis are known. Right, it's the knownness that the vrittis enjoy is the very swarupa, the very nature of consciousness itself. So if I use the word known, it's because that's a word that we use in the world. This is known, this is known, this is known, this is known. But actually, I could say self-evident consciousness plus this, self-evident consciousness plus this, self-evident consciousness plus this namarupa, self-evident consciousness plus the whole maya upadhi. That self-evident consciousness is what we label as known in the world. This is known, this is known, this is known. I could say, you know, this Maya has for its being self-evident consciousness. And because of ignorance, that self-evident consciousness is taken to be the consciousness that the world enjoys or the knownness that the world enjoys. So for the self-evident consciousness, there is not a knower there. There aren't sense organs, there isn't a body. All of these things that exist within Maya belong to Maya. All the things that exist within duality belong to duality. They are illumined or lit up by me and assume knownness and knowership depending upon the nature of the upadhi. If the upadhi is the mind and the sense organs, then they gain knowership in reference to the known object. Right? But it's really just consciousness plus the instrument of knowing, or consciousness with the object of knowledge. So really, there's just only consciousness. The consciousness is threefold within the creation. It's the consciousness, knower consciousness, pramana consciousness, object of the pramana, the pramaya consciousness. The really consciousness is the adhishtana of the whole thing. Good way to kind of play with this and start to really understand it is just to practice having an imagination. That you can have an imagination is amazing. It's a miraculous thing, you know, but we take it for granted because we've always had imaginations. But when you think about it, what is this? Just incredible. You can have an imagination, you can imagine a whole world going on, you can travel in your imagination, all these types of things. And it is a beautiful drishtanta for understanding this knowledge. Because whether it's an imagination and your relationship, the relationship of conscious being to the imagination, it's really not different than the relationship of conscious being to the whole creation. Both are nitya. So satyam, nitya, and both. So it can really help you to kind of understand Ishwara's situation. So you're the little Ishwara of your imagination. So I hope that helps. There's a lot to know here. So we'll keep unwinding. The Mahavakyas are pointing to the non-difference between oneself as the jiva and oneself as Ishwara, yet the teaching seems to unfold about Brahman. Please explain. Yeah, good. Here's a couple of different Mahavakyas. The one that we were working with earlier in the Panchadashi is Tat Tvam Asi. You are that. And often this Mahavakya is used if I were to label the pronouns with what the pronouns are referring to, would be you, O Jiva, you the Jiva, are Ishwara. And why we would say it like that instead of you are that, it could be, well, just as well, you, O conscious being, are yourself is infinite. You could say something like that. But usually we use the pronouns to refer to me, this body, mind, sense, organs, conscious being. and the tat to refer to Ishwara. Okay? So you, O conscious being, you are Ishwara. What we have to do in a Mahavakya like that is to, if you remember this Bhagatyaga Lakshana, we have to drop off from each one, the jiva and Ishwara, the upadis. Upadis, which are mitya. When you drop off the mitya upadi, then what is left is oneself. I need to understand something more about this question. See, it says the Mahavakyas are pointing to the non-difference between oneself as the jiva and oneself as Ishwara. And that's the tattvamasi, okay? Yet no teaching seems to unfold about Brahman. Well, it does unfold about Brahman, because the Ishwara Upadi, just for this Mahavakya for now, the Ishwara Upadi as the self, that's why we call Ishwara God, and the Ishwara Upadi is limitless, is infinite. And so that means that the self, you would imagine, is infinite also. Ishwara is big, you think the self is big too. Then, that's not correct, but anyway. Then you think of yourself is little, the self is little. So you've got this little self and this big self. So, because I'm little, I, this conscious being, this body, mind, sense organs, I'm little compared to infinite Ishwara. So how can a little me be infinite Ishwara? In order to know that, a lot of teaching has to be done in order to understand all of the component parts of the jiva, and then to understand that all of those component parts are objectifiable, are subject to subject-object relationship, and so therefore are intrinsically not you. What is intrinsically you is the conscious being, because of which all of these things are known. Then we have to go over to Ishwara. There's a lot of teaching that has to take place to understand that also the Ishwara Upadi, this whole infinite creation, is objectifiable from the standpoint of the self also. The whole creation is objectifiable. If it's objectifiable, it exists within time and space. Conscious being that Ishwara enjoys can't be existing within time and space. You can't see conscious being walking around for Ishwara. You can't see conscious being walking around for the jiva. And so what has to happen here is everything, upadis, the Ishwara upadis, which are Ishwara, Hiranyagarbha, Virat, these Ishwara upadis have to be negated. That's Bhagatyaga. You negate a part of Ishwara, all that can be objectified. Then in terms of the Twampada, Twam, you have to negate all of the Jiva upadis, right, because they can be objectified, subject-object relationship. And then you're left with consciousness, with nothing in between to differentiate, because space itself is objectified. So all of these, this teaching methodology is involved living one non-dual infinite consciousness with that we call Brahman. So Brahman is conscious being, which is non-dual, which is infinite. In order for us to understand that one conscious being is non-dual, this creation has to become mitya. It can't have a separate reality. If it has a separate reality, Brahman is not dual. It's not non-dual, because there's non-dual Brahman and dual creation. A real dual creation, and then non-dual Brahman, that's two, right? And so for something to be non-dual, it has to be one without a second. There can't be two in any form at all. And so non-dual means one without a second. The only thing here is Brahman. For us to be able to say that the only thing here is Brahman is for everything objectifiable to be in the category of mitya, that it has no existence, no being, no consciousness of its own, that it has a dependent relationship on Brahman as its adhishtana. So to make all of this clear, all of the Upanishads are circling around this. They all do it in a little bit different ways, but that what they call the tatparya, the thing that is actually being taught by the Upanishad, is the Mahavakya Tattvamasi. Or, just to bring in Brahman, Aham Brahmasmi. That's another Mahavakya. Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. What would that mean? is that this self that is me is limitless. This self that I've always taken to be limited, because the upadis, of course, are limited, is actually Brahman. Brahman, who, as taught in the Upanishads, it's an Upanishadic word, is what? Is non-dual, is infinite. And so how can that be? The same thing, Bhagatyaga Lakshana. The parts that make me limited, I have to differentiate myself from them to recognize that this Atma is Brahman. But if, as long as this Atma, myself, is superimposed on the body, the mind, the sense organs, all of the upadis, then how can I be Brahman? I'm not infinite, you know. I'm not Ishwara. How can you say I'm Ishwara? If you say Aham Brahmasmi, how can I be Brahman? There's nothing infinite about me. There's nothing non-dual about me. So there's why so much teaching is involved, to first differentiate myself from all of these upadis, which are all become all part of Ishwara, and then to establish that Ishwara is Mithya. So the Satya-Mithya relationship that we have with any form of duality is essential to understanding that you are Ishwara. Okay. So I think that's... So we do teach you are Brahman. And we use Atma, Brahman, all of these, but now that we're in the Kena Upanishad, they don't really want to use these words very much. They're doing all kinds of work to first reveal what it is and then use the word, because otherwise the word becomes one more thing. They're so careful to not let that happen. I know that taking care of my psyche and inner children is for Antakarana Shuddhi, but sometimes I feel I instead go into self-improvement project. Into a self-improvement project. I think that's what that says. When it comes to working on myself, for example, feeling guilty if I don't feel dharmic enough or saintly enough. Since there will always be unconscious stuff coming up, it seems like an endless project to improve my personality. Can you talk about this topic? Yeah, please. Well, I would say there's kind of a little shift you can make in the way that you think about this. And that is, just as you are, you don't have to become an angel. You just, as you are, is good. It's fine. Unless it causes you pain. Because for you, for all of us, when there's some pain, just a little bit of pain, you can just blow it away. It's not any big deal. We don't bother with it. There's all these little pains and little things. You let those things go. But there are bigger pains where I really feel hurt inside, or I really feel angry and beside myself, you know, frustrated, upset, whatever. We have a lot of words that we use for states that we would rather not be in, you know. And so in terms of Antakarana Shuddhi, these states are something that I would love to outgrow so that I don't have to experience them anymore, so that my mind has a natural shanti and I can be with the world and be with others in a way that's not upsetting to me and not hurtful to me. So whether you're a samsari or a jnani, these things that take place inside of us that are hurtful to us, our whole system would like to cure them. It's like a mental illness instead of a physical illness. Our natural tendency is to try to help that situation. So that is a lot different than judging yourself, saying, was I kind enough when I said that? Or, am I saintly enough? Am I really saintly enough to deserve this knowledge, or saintly enough to even get this knowledge? Or how do I become saintly enough? This kind of thinking is really problematic because there's no end to it. You'll never be saintly enough because you could always be more saintly. We're in duality, you know. Duality doesn't have an end, right? So this, if we say we have these comparative and superlative, good, better, best. But the thing is, the better goes on forever, and then the best goes on forever. You know? Honestly, it's a very frustrating pursuit. So you don't need that. The only so-called saintly one is Brahman, is yourself, your own being. Because you can't improve on that, you can't make it worse. It is what is the beloved for you and for all beings. You know, and that means it is the maximum ananda in terms of not a bliss bubble, but in terms of wholeness or well-being, you know. And you already are that. That's who you are. And that can't be improved upon. So now it's just a question of having a mind, my mind, which has been, you know, tossed around in samsara from beginningless time, you know. So we have scars and habits and this problem and that problem and things that make us sad and things that make us feel hurt and unhappy. And so those are what we can call pratibandhakas from just being being my natural self, even in terms of the upadhi, where my natural self is just a mind that's happy with itself, you know. If it's not, then I'm reacting to something. There's something bothering me, you know. Or if I'm feeling really angry, or if I have a lot of bitterness, that's because there's some hurts inside that are hurting me, bothering me. That's not my natural condition. Here's one way you can tell it's not your natural condition, is because you don't want it. You want it to go away. Right? If it was just your natural condition, then you would be so happy. This is who I am. Everything is fine. But we don't feel that way. We feel like, I would like to be free of these type of pains. And so the antaka, when we say antakarana shuddhi, we are working, it's a term that we use in reference to gaining this knowledge, that my mind has the shanti, you know, that has a natural shanti, a natural dharma, and so is available to gain this knowledge. That's what the antakarana shuddhi is about. Let my mind have enough shanti to really gain this knowledge. So we're doing that type of, we'll call it upayanishta. We're working on these things in so many different ways to get my mind comfortable with itself by working out all of these traumas and bad habits and whatnot. So that's not becoming a saint. That's just becoming a normal person. Nobody's a normal person. We're not normal people. What I mean by normal people is where all of these hurts and things that is also normal. That's why our system does everything it can to handle all of these things, but they cause us pain. And so what I mean by not normal is that I'm not comfortable with those. Like I feel like my body is normal when it's more or less invisible. It's just working for me and everything's fine. There's no special pain. There's nothing wrong. And so that's fine. That's normal. Or say my leg hurts, or I've got something going on, you know, with my something or other, something's not working right, then I have to take care of that. So that's what I do. And when your mind is hurting you, the unconscious is hurting you, or, you know, you're uncomfortable, then we want to take care of it. And that's normal to want to take care of it. And then when those pains and things are gone, we feel just really comfortable. So we want a comfortable upadhi to whatever degree we're able to do that. And then so that I can gain knowledge. And when I gain knowledge, then these upadhis, my body, mind, sense organs, we do our best. But now we have the absolute comfort of me, which is not dependent. That absolute comfort of me is not dependent on the mind being this way or that way. You know? And the mind has me as its inner sanctuary. And so there's a tremendous amount of relaxation that takes place then, and also a freedom from having to be better. You can't make yourself better. That's such a big deal for the West. You mean I don't have to always feel like I'm not good enough. You know, if I could be a little bit better. I should be a little bit better. That's also a complex human complex. The self can't be better and it can't be worse. There's tremendous freedom in that. Yeah. So I wouldn't think at all about, am I saintly enough or am I good enough? I would just deal with my hurts and pains with all of the tools that we have, all the things that we teach around that. And of course, if you're mean to somebody else, you will feel bad about it. It's the law. Whatever you give to another person, you feel. If you love another person, you feel love. If you're happy with another person, you feel happiness. If you hate another person, you feel hate. If you're agitated with another person, you feel agitation. You get to experience everything that you give. So then, we try not to give those things so we don't have to experience. That's why one of the things I love is that, when you say you have somebody that you have a problem with or some situation that's always problematic for you, you can invoke your Ishtadevata or invoke in meditation your mature self, how you will be when your mind, how you imagine yourself to be, how you would love yourself to be, how you would be when your knowledge is mature. And then you can imagine yourself as that, invoke that, be that Ishtadevata. And then see how you would treat that person. Another way to language that is to say, how would I like to be toward that person? How would I like to feel about that person? How would I like to act toward that person? To me, that's a really powerful meditation and practice, because it's much more than how you want to be toward that person. It's really about how you want to be. Yeah. And certain ways of behavior are pretty bundicus for you. They're obstructions for you because you don't value it. You just fall into that. Yeah. But it makes you feel bad. So if your behavior in any way makes you feel bad about yourself, you have to change the behavior. How to change the behavior? Well, one really good way is to invoke your Ishtadevata or invoke your higher self or whatever language you want to use. And then you'll start to see who you really are. Honestly, who you really are, what your value system really is, and how that feels, because it feels really wonderful when you do that. And then you get a value for being that way. And when you're not being that way, that becomes a sadhana for you to own that up, because that is more normal, more natural for you than the other, because the other causes you pain. So it's not about being saintly enough or good enough. You're already good enough because you're here. So nobody would be here in these classes who's not a mumukshu. You'd be bored to death. What is she talking? Oh my God. How long is she going to go on? That means there's some really tremendous punya. That's as the tradition says. But I so, not just because the tradition says it, I believe that. It's not normal. It's not the normal what the world is really for. The world is really meant to fulfill your desires and, do all of these kind of things and suffer all that because of the raga dvesha, Take responsibility for yourself and try to make your way and try to be successful and all of these things. And the mumukshu says, what's this really about? Because this doesn't work. You kind of see through the whole charade and realize this is not going to work no matter how hard I try. It's not going to work. And so then when you really see that, then you kind of throw your hands up to Bhagavan and ask to be rescued. Because you realized you can't rescue yourself from this situation. You can live, and you can live a dark dharmic life and make it as peaceful and happy as possible, but it's still a bondage. So, in many traditions, there is the focus on transcending the ego. How do we make sure we don't end up as just a spiritually informed ahankara? Yes. Okay. I think the transcending the ego, I've heard that language also. I know what is meant by that. But I think that when people are talking about transcending the ego, often there's a meditative practice involved. So, and also there's the idea that you don't really know what's behind the ego. It's almost, it's like saying we have to transcend our mind, you know. And what is it that's behind the mind? What, how do we transcend the mind? How do we transcend the ego? And so often, when those type of spirituality, spiritual practices, they actually want to transcend the mind, transcend the ego. So maybe there's just a nirvikalpa samadhi state, you know. I don't really know, because it doesn't. It's even interesting, like, if you ask, what do you mean by ego? That's also very fuzzy. What do you think they mean by ego? Immediately you might just say ahamkara, that I notion. But that's too much knowledge. It's not just ahamkara. Ahamkara means that yourself is here, the self that you are is here, but because of self-ignorance, the mind takes itself to be the self. And then it's located in the body, and through the sense of touch, the subtle body pervades this body, so it takes this to be the conscious being, and so I am this. That's the ahamkara. I don't really think that is necessarily, I think that's too complicated. I don't think that's what's meant by ego, by transcending the ego or transcending the mind. My only, in my experience with that type of language, it means that the mind is basically not useful at all. And the mind has to, the whole mind, to gain self-knowledge, which they should, we should say to gain enlightenment or some other kind of word, the mind has to be transcended. So the mind is no longer functional in terms of gaining self-knowledge. It has to be transcended. So to transcend the mind, if you go through the Ashtanga Yoga, the kind of the Eightfold Path, follow the Niyamas and Niyamas, kind of the what they teach for really bringing about a dharmic person, so that there's a good degree of shanti. And then there's exercises like the asanas and pranayama to try to make the almost transcend the body through making it so relaxed that you can't feel it. You know, and then do the pranayama to really absorb the mind, which it does, and so you can hopefully transcend the mind. Then turning the prana, or turning the very absorbed mind, making that dhanana, you know, pratyahara, bringing in all of the sense perception, so you're not experiencing that. The body is totally relaxed. Turn the mind, make it single pointed on a given point, whatever that may be, depending upon the tradition, and then keep an anuvritti, a flow of consciousness going toward that alone. So at that time you transcend any kind of experience of the world or of the mind, and then that gives you knowledge of that state of samadhi. And that state of samadhi is the state of enlightenment. And then in the Yoga Sutras, you want to have done that enough so that you just stay there. The problem is that's very difficult to do, and so they will say that you have that anuvritti, and then you have to drop the body. When the body drops, then you'll just be abiding as the purusha. The purusha which has transcended the mind, because all of the prakriti has become silent because of the practice, turning the mind inward, and also living the yamas and niyamas means a very dharmic life. And there's, I don't remember all of them. I can go through them for you another time. But so the yamas and niyamas are kind of universal also in terms of how to be in the world, as the type of person to be in the world, so that you're not agitated. So you can say, if you're talking about transcending the mind, now you've transcended the mind, what happens when you come back? So do you have to transcend the mind permanently? That permanent transcendence of the mind is liberation. That's actually thought. But then what happens when you come back? Well, then you should meditate again more so that you can transcend the mind for a longer period. Now, when the mind is transcended, what is your experience of the world. There is no experience of the world. When the mind is transcended in Nirvikalpa Samadhi or in Savikalpa Samadhi, there is no world. And so now, is that the state of enlightenment? Is that the state of Ajivan Mukta? Ajivan Mukta is somebody, while living, they are liberated. So would you say that that's Ajivan Mukta? Living liberated. Living liberated, living in Nirvikalpa Samadhi. Living liberated is living in Nirvikalpa Samadhi until the body drops. So I think I've explained that way more than a person who thinks you have to transcend the mind could possibly explain it. which kind of means that those are buzzwords. Often they're just buzzwords that don't have any logic. They don't have any content. It's just meditate and see what happens, basically. You don't know what you're talking about. But the other problem, if that sounds ego-y on my part, it's not meant to be. The other problem is that we don't even know until we do, and until you get to the right teaching. We don't even know what we're supposed to know. We don't even know that there's something to be taught, really. We don't know what we don't know. That's the thing. And there's, say, I'm talking mostly about a Westerner, especially in the States, with all these different kinds of gurus, especially in the 60s and 70s. There was an onslaught of gurus, and they all seemed to have so much shanti, sitting and so peaceful and everything, and meditating. We didn't know what meditation was. Really, we just learned about it from these people. They were dressed in orange and they had a few things to say. And they seemed much calmer than anybody in the States. So we attributed all of these great things to them. It didn't turn out, for the most part, to be very true. There was a lot of really not good things happening. But that isn't even the point. The point is that we didn't know anything. And so all of these terms seem very magical and important, and will I ever be able to do that? I thought I might have to, because of Yogananda's book, I thought I might have to jump off the mountain and kill myself so that I could take another better body, so that I would be able to be pure enough to gain this knowledge. This knowledge, which I had no idea what that was. And all these disciples were at such subtle bodies that they were almost walking on air. Seriously, you have to go back and read this Yogananda book. Almost walking on air. It was so subtle. And this one poor fellow, he wasn't really walking on air like the others. And so he had to jump off a cliff so he could get a better body, so that he could gain this knowledge. I was serious when I read that book, and I was really depressed. I wanted to gain that knowledge, that liberation, and it seemed absolutely hopeless. Till I met Swamiji, and then I told him I'd jump off the cliff for him if I could get here. That's what I needed to do to get this knowledge. That is heavy-duty confusion. So I think this ego and transcending the ego and transcending the mind is heavy, heavy-duty confusion. I'm glad I got out of it. Really glad. I see it just a lifelong pursuit of intense suffering, because it doesn't work. That's my opinion on it. Sometimes we see non-mumukshu people and non-spiritual seekers that can have a higher sensibility than us, more attentive to others, more generous, more empathic. Therefore, what are the drivers of human sensitivity? Yeah, no, I think that's completely true. And I think the drivers is really Dharma, because as you mature, as you become sensitive to what really makes you happy, it's really not sensory pursuits. You know, let me have this thing so I can be happy. Let me have this situation so I can be happy. Or the competitions and all of these things. Those gives only the most fleeting happiness, little sukha-vrittis. But they're only fleeting. Whereas Dharma gives a more balanced, long-lasting ananda, even though relative. And so the whole creation, you don't have to be a mumukshu for this. You realize more and more that the more giving you are, the happier you are. The more caring you are, the happier you are. You know? The more kind you are, the happier you are. And so the mind starts to, because of Dharma, and Dharma's the great teacher, really, the mind tends to become much, much more relaxed and also knows what makes you happy. You know because of experience. And so the more you give, the more you give. You know, the kinder you are, the kinder you are. Really, you can say, isn't that wonderful, what a kind person? And it is wonderful. But the fact is that kind person is a happy person, and they also know it. You know that when you're kind and caring and giving, even if it's hard to do sometimes, it's, you feel so happy yourself, you know, and so you your own happiness trains you to do that more and more and more. Even one of the hardest things, Swamiji was telling me about this, and I don't remember what his source was, maybe just general experience. It's hard to give money, you know. There's a resistance to giving money because money has so much to do with your security, your own well-being, that you can pay the rent, that, you know, you want to collect it and be able to buy a house or whatever. So money, there's so much security wrapped up in money that sometimes it's hard to give it. And then sometimes you find yourself in a situation where you think, I really want to give to this person or to this situation or whatever it is. And you really want to, and you feel really happy that you want to, and you're going to give it, and then you don't. And you don't because of certain levels of fear and insecurity around your own security. And so Swamiji has actually given, you know, partial lectures on this. And then he says, then you should just give. You just give and see how you feel. You know, see what happens. You know, push yourself a little bit to see what that's like. And so I used to do that. I mean, it's not that I do give. I mean, I think we all give. But that's not exactly what I'm talking about. I'm talking about noticing a certain love and ananda that takes place when you give. And he happened to be talking about money because money can be hard to give. But when you do give, even though it's hard to do, there's some ananda, freedom that comes from that, something beautiful that comes from that. And so that's an example that he used several times. But it can really be anything. Giving of your time, you know, caring about people. The more we do that, the more we do it. And the only way that we can become a giving person is to give. The only way we can become a kind person, this is all Swamiji, but it's always helped me. The only way we can become a kind person is to be kind. A gentle person, to be gentle. That's the only way, you know. How else are you going to do that? So you have to just, to become it, you have to do it. So people who have learned that are very, very, very saintly people. And they can also take a birth. You can also go back to the last life also. And they can be born with a lot of those samskaras because of having accomplished those dharmas in their last life. And so when they take this birth from childhood, from babyhood, they can have a very beautiful, very beautiful, very giving heart. Yeah. So we say, oh, they brought beautiful samskaras with them. Some of us, we're not that kind or not that giving, but then you have the value. And then that, because of that, you practice being kind. You practice caring. You know? And then you become kind and then you become caring. So, you know, there's people that are very, very kind and loving and wonderful to be around. You're much, much more kind and giving than any jnani. So jnani, being a jnani is not about that you're the kindest person in the world. You can be such a kind person. It has to do with dharma and your experience. The experience of the fruits of dharma. Can you please talk about anxiety from a Jung and or Vedanta perspective? Too much for me tonight. I will, though. I will talk about that. I just can't do it right now. I don't know if I can do it anymore. What is it that makes Brahman into an intelligent consciousness? I'm done. I don't want to be done. It's not that I want to be. It's just everything shut down and all the lights started going out. What can I do? Nope, it's over. It happens to me all the time, even when I'm teaching at home, you know. My Thursday night and my Sunday night class, I'll be teaching away, and then all of a sudden that moment comes where the lights go out. And everybody knows. And it's over. I don't know. It's okay.
Svasti prajabhyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishah go brahmanebhyah shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini Desho yamsho parahitaha Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarvesham swastir bhavatu Sarvesham shantir bhavatu Sarvesham purnam bhavatu Sarvesham mangalam bhavatu Sarve bhavantu sukhinah, sarve santu niramayah, sarve bhadrani pashyantu, ma kaschit dukha bhag bhavet, asato ma satkamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritam gamaya, Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om
So let's keep some